Welcome to episode 37 of Redesigning Cities, the Speedwell Foundation Talks at Georgia Tech. Our topic today is place-based activism and democracy. I'm your host, Ellen Dunham Jones, professor and director of the MS in Urban Design at Georgia Tech. Today, I am very pleased to have a conversation with Dr. Sharon Igreta Sutton, FAIA. She is an educator, author, fine artist, and citizen architect who holds 5 academic degrees. Currently a distinguished visiting professor at Parsons, she previously served on the architecture faculties of Columbia, Pratt, University of Cincinnati, Michigan, and the University of Washington. Dr. Sutton was the first African-American to receive the AIA ACSA Topaz Medallion for Excellence in Architectural Education. Brava. And the 12th African-American woman to be licensed to practice architecture in the United States. Yesterday, she gave a lecture at Georgia Tech on her 6th book, Pedagogy of a Beloved Commons, Pursuing Democracy's Promise Through Place-Based Activism. We include a link to the lecture on our website, and I strongly recommend it. Welcome, Sharon. You have been a pioneer in so many ways, and it's an honor to have this conversation. In your lecture, and I don't want to rehash everything in the lecture, but you showed us inspiring examples of how 2 organizations in disinvested neighborhoods empowered youth to improve their neighborhoods and their common land with place-based activism. And then you challenged both the education and the profession of architecture for too often treating placemaking as profit-making and treating community engagement as extractive. Tell our audience a bit more about that challenge and really the opportunities that it suggests for democracy.
Well, first of all, good morning, everyone. And thank you, Ellen, for inviting me.
My pleasure.
And for a great lead-off question. You know, placemaking is people, it's looking at the creation of the spatial environment, the built environment, as a process rather than a product, and a social process in which people are really debating their collective values and how they want to live together. So it's an opportunity for people to come together and talk about what's important to them. And there's too little of that. So I think that's the huge benefit of, you know, what I refer to in my book as critical placemaking, which is not the idea that you're doing placemaking to improve its marketability, but that the placemaking process is the process of people coming together and debating how they want to live together as a community. And there's really nothing more important than that.
It absolutely, when it works, it absolutely is creating democracy, but people don't always agree on what their community should be.
Well, that's the challenge, is learning to accept what you don't totally agree on and support it. And I think that's our huge challenge today, is that people cannot agree on much of anything. And, you know, we can't go forward without agreement.
Yeah. Well, I thought it was especially fascinating how much you focused on these youth organizations, and especially disadvantaged youth of color, as we know, are so often really burdened by others' negative preconceptions. Providing them the opportunity to develop the kind of critical consciousness that you've spoken about and turn their energy into productive protest, repairing the land, whether it's murals, you know, any number of activities that have so many good ripple effects. But is that kind of work really limited to marginalized youth? Can it work with more diverse groups to enable wider circles to learn to live together? Maybe immigrants or migrants who haven't been in the community for so long. I'm just sort of wondering about, you know,
well, let's start with
which communities
the term that you used, protest. One of the things that I struggled with in writing the book was the idea of activism. So activism, typically we think of, I think, as protest, of being in the street and or sitting at a lunch counter or, you know, sitting in a classroom or a university, stopping something, blocking something, entering something where you're not supposed to be. So, and I think there's a limit to that. I'm very supportive of that form of protest, but I wanted, and I really got this idea from Grace Lee Boggs, who lived to be 100 years old. And in her later years, she was a protest activist in Detroit with her auto worker husband for all of her life. She was an Asian American who was trained as an academic and never got a job because of her demographic bio, and switched over into being an activist. In the last part of her life, she began talking about activism as practical problem solving. I think she called it community activism. And that seems to me to be, so that's the opposing. There's activism as protest and activism as hands-on productive work. And going to your question then, yes, anyone can be involved in productive work. As a matter of fact, my students who are my design students currently are thinking about the migrant crisis and how migrants, instead of just waiting for someone to solve their problem and having various groups protesting about the solutions, of being involved in doing the solution hands-on, you know, making your own solution. So yes, I think that anyone can be involved in place-based. It's basically improving the place where you are.
But it still always takes someone to do that organizing.
And it also takes a certain dissatisfaction. You know, creativity begins with a dissatisfaction with the world, with what ought to be. So then it's what you do with your ought to be. And yes, it takes someone to, in the case of, you know, if you're going to be creative in your studio, you don't need somebody else. But if you're going to be creative with other people, it does take that person or group or organization that will organize a group of people to figure out what their shared disaffection is and how they can take a proactive approach to addressing that.
And it seems like most of the examples, but maybe not all of them, that the emphasis is really on the common land, the public, something that is, whether it's literally public land, it's certainly used by a larger community. And one of my favorite quotes, I'll paraphrase, but you know, you've talked about the living, learning that it's those decisions about what we hold in common, that common land, that are where we have to practice living together. Aristotle said the purpose of public space is to teach us how to live together well. Yeah. It's a high bar. I challenge my students all the time. You know, how do you really design this public space to teach us how to live together well. You know, your examples of the role of the communal care seem to me to be very important, that the role of the maintenance, that it's something that people voluntarily are doing. And it brought to my mind, I love some of the examples of tactical urbanism. Now it's become, you know, legalized and endorsed by cities, but there were sort of guerrilla efforts of people yarn bombing. And I never understood who has the time to knit little cozies for traffic meters or tree trunks, but studies absolutely show that if people were yarn bombing went in, crime went down, it was a way of showing that people cared about this place, and individuals, not just the city's maintenance crew, were taking care of a place. What advice do you have on the design of public space that can teach and foster living together well, not just pretty placemaking for profitability?
Well, the environment teaches, whether it's teaching you to live together well or not, the environment is a literal textbook. That's my second book, Weaving a Tapestry of Resistance, talked about the environment as a textbook specifically for children. You know, if you live in a place with gated neighborhood, that says something about what your relationship is with people outside of the gate. That's a lesson. If you live in an environment that no one picks up the trash or repairs the homes, or there's no bus, that's a lesson. And unfortunately, and you know, there's the environment, and there are the people who live in that environment. And the lesson about the environment is telling you who you are. So this idea of people taking over and creating their own story is the great value of upending the negative lessons that exist in the environment today, which are many. You know, the best way to travel is in a car. That's a lesson. Young people see all the cars and they think that's the way we ought to travel. If you see small houses, if you see big, those become your expectations. So this idea of people, you know, of creating the environment that teaches you to live well. First of all, you have to think about what creates a good life, which is analyzing what's not right in the life that you have. If you live in the gated community, is this working for me or is it not working for me? It's a dangerous question to ask, but it's a question that has to be asked. If you live in the community without services, what's wrong with this? So first and foremost is people coming together to envision what ought to be. And that's where you get a different lesson. But the environment's going to teach you.
So my research has always focused on suburbia, which is where we see the majority of the gated communities and the travel by car and a lifestyle that most Americans live in and most Americans do feel is the right way to live, the safe way to raise their family, all of those things. Tell me about you. Participated in an exhibition on decolonizing suburbia. Mm-hmm. Were you trying to display some of those lessons? Or tell us about.
Well, we used, we were kind of on a slippery slope with the issue of suburbia because Cincinnati, Ohio, and specifically the Avondale neighborhood, which was the one next to where I grew up, which was Avondale had two parts. the historically black neighborhood and a Jewish neighborhood. It had at one time only been a Jewish neighborhood, and then as the suburbs developed, the northern part of it, the Jewish people moved out of that area, and the black people from my neighborhood spilled over into that area. But Cincinnati actually had a suburban fabric. It's an interesting town to look at, or city to look at, because it was very much like Atlanta in that it developed around a streetcar because of the hills. And this was on the first hill out of the downtown. But it had a very suburban fabric. And what I remembered about it were these quite large houses with very big lots. And the other interesting thing about it is that it experienced the decline from suburbanization. So it was an urban neighborhood that had a suburban fabric that had the decline of white flight to build other suburbs. So it's, it's not such a clear story all the time. So we thought that would be an interesting challenge to take on, looking at how you could, rather than looking at a suburban community that is more a white community, to look at this African-American community that had very low density housing and say, how can you increase the density in a way that prevents displacement due to gentrification because of its location to downtown? So it was a little bit convoluted story, but we had a good time looking at it.
And it is fascinating to, I think, really look at and understand how race does and doesn't repeat the same patterns. There's almost an expectation, I think, as designers, we want to find what makes this place unique. And I think a lot of people in Atlanta want to sort of assume that, well, a black neighborhood physically should be different from a white neighborhood. And it's really not the case. We want to give visual expression to everything.
I'm going to take you on a little detour if I could tell a story that... when I was working in Ann Arbor and in Detroit at the University of Michigan, we were working with a community client, and the university had become very protective of students working in Detroit and gave us a long list of rules of we could only go in a group, we could only be blah, 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 blah. And our client was also telling us that the neighborhood was a place that we should never go unsupervised, so that we couldn't just wander around to do a site visit. Well, the students got into a huge fight about how to approach the neighborhood, and their first part of the assignment was to make a proposition and a work plan, and they couldn't agree. One student, who was an older student, who was actually a public school teacher, former public school teacher, disappeared. Oh, my most logical student has disappeared in the midst of conflict, and the assignment is almost going to be due. He went into the neighborhood against the university rules by himself and introduced himself to people on the street, interviewed them, found out what they were doing to try to stave off the abandonment there, and then he photographed the houses so they looked like suburban houses because there was so much abandonment. If you pointed your camera in a certain direction, it looked like you were in the suburb. And then he brought it back and he juxtaposed his pictures of Detroit with pictures of suburbia. So this hides the whole idea of the stereotypes right on.
Yeah. Well, and I know here in Atlanta, Bill Stanley is the first African-American graduate from the School of Architecture at Georgia Tech. Yeah. And he knows that I don't like gated communities in general for many of the same reasons you mentioned. But he made a point of saying to me, Ellen, you don't understand. Atlanta has 8 black gated communities where homes start over $1 million. Yeah. LA has 2. Chicago has 1.
Right.
We have 8. Mm-hmm. And I said, Bill, great. Show me. Take me on a tour. And we did. And it was, I thought, really fascinating. Yeah. And at the end of the tour, I said, so Bill, why did you feel it was so important to show this to me? And he said, because when people use the term black community, the assumption is a low income, disinvested neighborhood. And, you know,
it's not true.
It is not true. And certainly in Atlanta, for me, this is the first city I've lived in where race and class do not automatically map onto each other at all. We're still striving to become the beloved community, and I think we still have a long way to go. Well, tell us about when the phrase beloved community, and you're using beloved commons, what do you think in physical terms Martin Luther King meant with that?
Well, he says very specifically that it's about people living across geographic boundaries as one. It's the it's Bucky Fuller's small planet concept, that we all live on the same earth and we can no longer be separate because we live together. And we're seeing that with the huge migration crisis worldwide, that, you know, no matter how big the wall is or strong the policies are, there are enough people in that are leaving their homes because of climate change, because of poverty, because of violence, that it's going to be hard to keep people out. So that's the beloved community, is a world that can live together without war, in Martin Luther King's terms. In my terms in the book, I'm talking about a smaller scale and a kind of neighborhood-based community where people are working together to make their immediate space habitable, more inhabitable, and more welcoming of people. And going back to Grace Lee Boggs, my 100-year-old Shiro, who's now passed away, she believed that many small communities could be together in one coalition and really bring about change. Kind of the Margaret Mead idea that, you know, a small group of people can make change. It's the only way you can. So having that local place-based investment in my community, I know the people there, I think is the route, the way out.
So we have a few minutes left. What advice do you have for folks who want to do this, who want to help work in their community, or are professionals who want to help and are going to work any community they have that chance? What advice do you have about both what first steps they need to take, and maybe preface that with what hasn't worked? What are strategies that you've seen people try but that just aren't working out? And whether that's a youth organization or a community design center or a university trying to engage, I mean, what doesn't work?
Right. Well, I had a great opportunity to look at that in the book, because I had 3 organizations and I looked at them over a period of 15 years, and 2 worked and the other one didn't. And so, not that it didn't totally, but not in the way the other ones did. And the one that did not, that kind of fell apart and almost disappeared, was the one that didn't build its own leadership, and also didn't, it wasn't community embedded. It was 2 people who came in from the outside to Detroit, ran the organization themselves without getting local people really involved in it, and then within the organization didn't grow the next generation of leaders. So when they grew old and retired, there was nobody to carry on the mission. So that's one issue. I think that a big challenge is the funding, because the foundation, whether it's foundations or governments or corporations, but especially corporations and the government, keep upping the things that you have to do to get the money. And so little groups that are community embedded, that are invested in building their leadership, have a difficulty getting the funding and also doing what they need to do to be successful change agents. And that was really what was so wonderful about the Hawaiian example, Ulupio, in that not only did they get funding, but they got funding to be so radical. So being able to do that is quite a trick.
Yeah. Is there anything cities in particular should be doing more of on the public sector side?
I'm thinking this very much in relation to the migrant crisis that's currently plaguing New York City, is the city cannot do it all. And so the city needs to empower and fund community-based organizations. Those organizations have a constituency. They have the trust of different ethnic and immigrant racial groups, special interest groups. Support the local groups. Don't try to do it all. It's like this: city governments say to the federal government, don't tell us what to do. The city should say the same thing to themselves.
Thank you so much, Sharon. I wish we could go on longer. I know we could, but we're going to get you to the plane. And thank you to all of our attendees. You've been listening to episode 37 of Redesigning Cities, the Speedwell Foundation Talks at Georgia Tech. If you'd like to hear more from Sharon, please watch the video of her lecture yesterday and her conversation with Christian Coles. There's a link to it and to our previous Redesigning Cities episodes on our website. Just Google Redesigning Cities podcast and you'll find it. This event will also be posted to our website, and we really look forward to more conversations.